As you make your way to a seat, feel free, if you have a copy of the scriptures with you, to open up to Exodus chapter 19. We'll be there momentarily. Exodus chapter 19. So, as Pastor Jim mentioned, we're getting ready, starting on Easter Sunday, to take a four-week break. It's always good in these long Old Testament books to talk a little bit more on Easter-themed ideas. But just to catch us up from where we've been, remember, Israel is enslaved in Egypt. They are dramatically rescued by God, and they're brought up to the Red Sea or the Sea of Reeds. God miraculously moves them across. There's grumbling in the next section of the journey because they're hungry, they're thirsty, and they're failing to depend upon God in those moments. And then they make it almost right to the place where they're intended to get to, which is Mount Sinai. If you remember, God had said to Moses, go get my people and bring them back to here so you can worship me together here. So the destination has always been Mount Sinai. They get super close to it, and then you remember the Amalekites attack from the north, a surprise attack, and there's this battle going on in the valley that Joshua is leading, and Moses has his hand stretched on the hill, and once again, though this time they're in physical combat, God delivers them. And then we have this interesting aside in Exodus 18, which perhaps is chronologically correct, or perhaps is kind of inserted there, we're not sure, where Moses gets some good information from his father-in-law about sharing leadership and how that's actually good for the whole body. And so that brings us this morning to Exodus chapter 19, which is really the lead up to a climactic moment in the book of Exodus, which we'll deal with next week, which is Exodus 20, or what many of you know as the Ten Commandments, right? When God finally gives his law to the people. But Exodus 19 really is the preparation for that. So I want to read to you, we don't have time to read through the whole chapter, but we're going to read the first 15 verses, and here is what the author says. It says, on the first day of the third month after the Israelites left Egypt, on that very day, they came to the desert of Sinai. After they set out from Rephidim, they entered the desert of Sinai, and Israel camped there in the desert in front of the mountain. Then Moses went up to God, and the Lord called to him from the mountain and said, this is what you are to say to the descendants of Jacob, and what you are to tell the people of Israel. You yourselves have seen what I did to Egypt, how I carried you on eagle's wings and brought you to myself. Now, if you obey me fully and keep my covenant, then out of all the nations, you will be my treasured possession. Although the whole earth is mine, you will be for me a kingdom of priests, a holy nation. These are the words you are to speak to the Israelites. So Moses went back, summoned the elders of the people, and set before them all the words the Lord had commanded to speak. The people all responded together, we will do everything the Lord has asked. So Moses brought their answer back to the Lord. And the Lord said to Moses, I am going to come to you in a dense cloud so that all the people will hear me speaking with you and they'll always put their trust in you. Then Moses told the Lord what the people had said. And the Lord said to Moses, go to the people and consecrate them today and tomorrow. Have them wash their clothes and be ready by the third day, because on that day the Lord will come down on Mount Sinai in the sight of all the people. Put limits for the people around the mountain and tell them, be careful that you do not approach the mountain or touch the foot of it. Whoever touches the mountain is to be put to death. They are to be stoned or shot with arrows. Not a hand is to be laid on them. No person or animal shall be permitted to live. Only when the ram's horn sounds a long blast may they approach the mountain. After Moses had gone down the mountain to the people, he consecrated them, and they washed their clothes. And he said to the people, prepare yourselves for the third day. Abstain even from sexual relations. This is the word of God for the people of God. What do we make of this? How do we understand this narrative? A decent amount is going on. Well, one of the paradigms to understand this that was put forward by the early rabbis in the first and second century, they called it Midrash, their interpretation of scripture. was the imagery really to be understood happening here is that of a wedding. So some of you, if you love going to weddings, this is going to be a fun day for you. Others of you, like me, who you're like, I'll go to the reception, but skip the wedding, please, at all costs. I even watched my own wedding back one time and thought, how did anyone make it through that thing? I did. And then in that moment, I decided any wedding that I will officiate will be short. So the imagery of wedding is really what is going to help us understand this. And I think you'll see it as we go through it and kind of dive a little bit deeper into the text. And it will help you understand that what's happening really in these chapters is God is marrying the people of Israel. Isn't that crazy? They're coming into a covenant relationship together. That's the imagery the author wants us to hear. And so then it shouldn't surprise us that how does this whole chapter begin? It begins with what amounts to a proposal, doesn't it? If we could say so, a little bit like a late elementary school, early junior high proposal. Remember that when you liked a girl or a boy and you weren't ready to talk to them directly, so you wrote it on a piece of paper and folded it together, right? Will you go out with me, right? You talked about that in elementary school, even though you never went out anywhere. You just were going out. You go out with me, check yes or check no. Do you remember that? Did you ever pass that note? Or were you ever one of the people who passed that along? Well, Moses is the note passer here, isn't it? God writes the note, gives it to Moses on top of Sinai. He brings it down to pass to Israel. And here's the proposal that God makes. He says, listen, you've seen what I've done for you, right? Now, we've all seen this because we've been reading Exodus together. It's undeniable who God is and what he's capable of. He uses a fantastic summary, one, because it's beautiful, two, because he invokes the image of an eagle. Can I get an amen, right? Even on your special day, Kevin, this is perfect. There it is. See, he's ready to be an elder. The imagery of God's rescue is like the rescue of an eagle who swoops down, not as a predator in that moment, but as a rescuer and flies high over the danger that surrounds Israel and brings them here to Sinai, this big nest where they can be rescued and restored and fed and sustained and nourished. This is the imagery of who God is. And the idea is if the people will join themselves to God, there's only more of this to come. This is who God is for them. But he takes it a step further. He says, listen, the whole world is mine, but you will be a special possession for me, a treasured possession. Do you ever have one of those? A treasured possession? Some of you right now, because you're super spiritual, you're turning and you're squeezing your wife or your husband's shoulder. You're my special possession, honey. Could be, right? But when you were kids, did you ever have that special possession, that thing that like you thought was the greatest thing ever, but it actually wasn't so great? Remember that? So like, I think I've told this story once before. I had this special possession when I was a kid that I thought was the greatest thing ever. Do you know what it was? It was the autograph of Jose Canseco. Some of you are laughing because you're old enough to know who Jose Canseco is, right? In the mid to late 80s, he was everything in baseball. Turns out he's a colossal cheater and a total loser as a human being, right? His steroids, he was a womanizer, he's the worst thing ever. But when I was a kid, I held on to this thing. I would show my friends, but only from a distance, right? Because we had gone to California on a vacation, and back in those days, baseball players had to stay in regular hotels. We stayed in the Hyatt right across from Disneyland. We were there for Disneyland. The A's were there to play the California Angels. And we stayed in the same hotel with all these people, and I met Jose Canseco. I had this thing. It was such great value to me. It turns out, not as valuable as I thought. That imagery is helpful for us here. I'm not suggesting that you're not as valuable as God says you are, but I'm suggesting to you that you're broken, right? And yet, God still holds you like that, right? And says, this is so precious to me. I'm going to put it behind glass and keep it safe. Others can look at it, but they can't get their hands on it. This is who you'll be. That's my proposal to you. He said, but if you're going to accept this proposal, there's something I need from you. And it's a simple word. I need your obedience. Right? Now, we look at that and think, oh, here we go. Law, legalism. That's not really the idea here at all. What I want to suggest to you is what God is actually asking of the people is for them to embrace a new identity. It fits the imagery of weddings because they're becoming his wife. They're becoming his bride. It's a new identity when you enter into a union like that. Because we know this. Why? Because what does he ask them to obey? I need you to obey the covenant. Now, all too often we hear that word and we know what's coming up next. We think, oh, he means the law he's about to give. But that wouldn't make sense because they didn't have that. But they did have a covenant, didn't they? You go all the way back. We've been saying this throughout this journey through Exodus, that Exodus and Genesis are inseparably bound. They can't be read apart from each other. So when you read this language, what he's doing is actually going all the way back to Genesis chapter 12, what we often call the Abrahamic covenant, where God says to Abraham things like, I'm going to make you a great nation. Did you hear that word nation in the very next verse? You're going to be plentiful. But in order to do it, you're going to have to take on a new identity. Remember, Abraham, he moves from where he was into a whole new place. This identity actually is about following God, even somewhat in the unknown. But there's more, because God says of Abraham, and I'm going to bless you like crazy. That treasured possession stuff, real. But it's meant not for you to be a container, so keep it for yourself, but actually a conduit, so you're a blessing to the nations. You're a nation to bless the nations. What's God saying to the people? I need you to embrace that covenant. If this is going to work, that's who you are. That's your new identity. And he affirms it by giving those two statements about them. Did you catch them? You'll be my treasured possession. You'll be for me a kingdom of priests, he says. What is that language? We haven't got to the point in the Pentateuch here where God outlines all of what a priest is in the religious ceremonies of things. And that's okay, because that's not what God's talking about here. He's talking about a priest that who functions as a mediator between God and others. What does this identity look like as covenant people? It looks like that we're serving as a go-between, a means by which others around us, the world, is able to see and know God and hear his voice and even respond to it. He says, you'll be a holy nation. What does that mean? Well, holy means that you'll be representative of God. Because if you really want to define holiness, the best way to define holiness is to, as best you can, take a mental picture of who God is. And God's saying here, I need you, therefore, in this priestly role to be a picture of me to the world. See, the church gets it wrong all too often, don't they? Holiness is for us. Mm-mm. God has always said holiness is something you embrace for the world. You see that? It's very different. It's not semantical. It's actually the difference between gospel and legalism. And this is what God is saying here. Here's this proposal. You've seen what I've done for you. All that and more. You'll be my special possession. Elsewhere in the Old Testament, God says things like, you'll be the apple of my eye. Do you know what that actually means in the original Hebrew language? You could translate it like this. You'll be the little person in God's eyeball. Do you know what that means? Have you ever gotten close enough to someone when you were looking at them and they were looking at you? You can see into their eyeball. Do you know what you see? See yourself, don't you? That's the imagery what God's talking about here, is his direct, unfettered gaze on you. Incredible. But in order for you to receive it, Israel, it means embracing this identity as a covenant people. You ask the question, well, how do we do that? Well, really, that's what's going to be unfolded in chapter 20, 21, 22, and 23. Practical ways that you can live into this covenant reality that are culturally bound in some ways and other things, but that's a sermon for the next couple of weeks. The idea here is, will you be my covenant people? Will you take on this new identity? Now, isn't it fascinating that here we have God who has supernaturally rescued these people, his own language, lifted them up on eagle's wings and taken them to a new place? the rescue is done, right? It's accomplished. They are set free. And yet he still turns to them and says, do you want to do this thing or not? Fascinating, isn't it? Because even from the Old Testament, our call to live a set apart life was never a means of earning liberation. It has always been a response to what God has already done. You see this? Incredible. And so even now, even still, even post plagues, post Red Sea, post victory over the Amalekites, God is saying, I'm not forcing myself on you, but if you want this covenant experience of feeling like a treasured possession, feeling the protection of a mother eagle, then you've got to embrace a new covenant identity. And the Israelites, probably somewhat naively, right, say, we're in, we'll do all of it. And they haven't even said what all of it means yet. You know, you've kind of had those moments before too, where you're like, I don't need to hear anything more. I'm all in. The Israelites say yes. The proposal is granted. A yes is given. A marriage ceremony awaits. You might say, well, this is different than how I proposed to my wife. And I would say, yeah, a lot different, right? Ancient Jewish weddings functioned a little bit different than modern American wedding customs. So often marriages were somewhat arranged, though not as forcefully as you might be led to believe. A woman had some level of say, depending upon how generous and loving her father was. But a wedding custom started out by a prospective groom offering something of incredible value to this woman and her family, right? Accomplished by God's rescue of them from Egypt. And then the next step was to make the formal arrangements for a union to happen. There was no get down on one knee at the beach or your favorite first date or whatever it was, all those romantic stories you have. That's not how it happened in those days. They actually sat down at a table and signed a contract. It was called a ketubah. That's a Hebrew word for a wedding contract. I would suggest to you that's what's happening right there. Some people want to point to Exodus 20 as a ketubah. I think that's wrong, because a ketubah in ancient Jewish customs had more to do with what the groom was going to give the wife and the new identity he was calling her to, rather than all the things he expected of his wife. Does this make sense? So you have this imagery, this beautiful picture of wedding customs developing. Well, do you know what happened after a ketubah was signed in ancient Jewish wedding customs? There was ritual cleansing. Isn't it fascinating? They would go in what was called a mikvah, the bride especially, in order to be fully cleansed. What is the very next thing that God says of the people? He says to Moses, now go consecrate them and make them wash their clothes. See, the wedding custom is unfolding even further. You ask the question, what does consecration mean? It's a great question. I don't have exactly a full answer to you. It's meant to be a little bit mysterious, I think. But I think all too often we tend to over-spiritualize things like this. There was no magic pixie dust, right? There was no abracadabras that were going on in this moment. It's certainly something in this place that God called Moses to do to the people. But if you read further, there are times when God calls the people to do it to themselves. I think it probably is some level of ceremony, some level of rite, something similar to what we just did with Kevin earlier today, that itself doesn't have any, you know, ability to do anything, but it demonstrates the gravity of the moment. And it speaks to a sense of understanding and embracing the gravity of the moment. My guess is when Moses is consecrating them, he's reminding them of who God is, of what God has done, of what this covenant is, of what this means, of what they've just agreed to, demonstrating the heaviness of it, but calling them fully into it. And then they've got to wash their clothes. Why? Well, this is an easier one to answer. Because they're dirty. Right? And not just because they've been wandering around in the wilderness for a long time, or in the desert in this particular time, which would make them dirty for sure. It's bigger than that. It's about being spiritually dirty. It's about being unable to come near to God because of the uncleanliness of themselves. If they're going to come to the foot of the mountain, they've got to be cleaned. And then it ends, the section ends, end of the weird section, and no one should have sex with each other, right? Well, that's so weird. Why do they say that? I think, again, because they're trying to build this wedding imagery. This is what would happen in this moment, is that they're beginning to be joined, but the union is not happening. Of course, it could just be for a seriousness and solitude and focus. We're not fully sure. At any level, it's an important moment, and they're preparing themselves for it. And then in the Jewish betrothal process, do you know what happens? Is that the ketubah is signed, the mikvah is entered into, and then they go and they exchange vows of sorts under what's called a chuppah, right? A chuppah is like a canopy. It's meant to symbolize a new family being built and God's covering over that new family. I think even in modern Jewish weddings, they still use these, I think. They would go stand under that and they would exchange vows, but only to be betrothed, not even to be married yet. Because after that, the groom would go away and would get everything in order to welcome his wife into it. What I would suggest to you is the end of this section of the reading, if you go all the way to the end of chapter 19, what you have here is the betrothal of Israel to God. They come to the foot of the mountain. God descends on the mountain. The mountain cowers over them almost as if it being a chuppah. And then there's the smoke that billows and covers over them. God and Israel are being betrothed. They, in essence, are legally married, even if not yet fully. And we expect this to be this incredible moment, don't you? Right? This moment of great celebration. And yet, if we read in the story, it's actually part celebration, part terror, if we're being honest. Right? There's these crazy noises that are happening. Trumpet blasts. Now, if you've ever been around a trumpet blasting for a long period of time, in the beginning, it's kind of interesting and cool. And then as it goes longer and louder, it gets super annoying, even unnerving. And this is what's happening here, and all the billowing that's going on. And there's this sense of like utter joy and utter terror in the same moment. But here's what I want you to know. Like, this is what it means to be in a relationship with a holy God. Right? We saw this in a different light all the way back at the Red Sea, right? The Red Sea is at the same time both a means of salvation for the people and a means of judgment for the Egyptians. You don't just get part of God, right? God's calling you into a full covenant with him. And there's a sense in which that ought to be heavy on us as well as light on us, joyful to us and bringing some semblance of fear. The holy God of the universe, the creator of all things, everything in the earth is his, but I'm the apple of his eye. That's at the same time extraordinary and terrifying, if we're being honest. And I would suggest to you, that's actually a very good view of God and how we're moving. But there's a couple other things here that are troubling, at least to me. Maybe you picked up on it. God keeps saying, listen, I want you to come to the foot of the mountain. We're going to be betrothed, but you better not touch it. You better not touch the mountain. He's like threatening to shoot them with arrows, which is crazy talk, isn't it? We'll stone you or shoot you there. No one's going to lay hands on you, but you're going to be dead. Don't touch the mountain for anything. In fact, if you keep reading to the end, Moses goes up to talk to God again, and God says to Moses, you remind them not to touch the mountain. And Moses is like, God, we got it, right? We've already told them. We understand. Is that even with this ritual cleansing, there's still a separation. Do you see it? They're still unable to fully get into complete proximity to God. That he can descend to the top of the mountain. They can come to the base of the mountain, but they can't touch the mountain they're on. And so God says, well, send Moses up. So there's this ongoing reality that in this marriage union between God and his people, it's actually going to be fully dependent on people like Moses to make it happen. Moses in this story, the high priests going forward and other religious leaders, that Israel is going to have to depend upon them and trust them, some of whom are far less than trustworthy, in order to maintain a relationship with God. And you can almost see right from the beginning, even at the wedding ceremony, that this relationship is tenuous. Is this going to work out? What is it going to take to actually be close to God? What do we need in order to actually be able to get up the mountain and be where God is? And these are important questions to ask, because if you go on reading the rest of the Old Testament, you'll find out that God does come to dwell closer with them in the land. It's a wedding of sorts, like the final moment where God delivers them their place to live in the land. But ultimately, the Old Testament ends with what you might describe as a divorce, where God's glory leaves the temple and goes away from the people, and the people are sent into exile. Why? Because they've taken idols. I don't want to steal glory from next week's sermon, but to take an idol is a sign of spiritual adultery. You've cheated on God. You've been unfaithful in your marriage to God. And so we're left knowing, the story continues in this way, asking these questions and trying to make sense of it. And all of this points to the cultural reality into which Jesus arrives. You see it? That God has made this promise, but we can't get to it. What do we need to do? How are we going to figure this out? How do we get God's glory back here? How do we make sense of this? What kind of people do we need to be? There's all kinds of sects of people who are suggesting different things. We need to get so serious about the law that we create 17 more layers of the law so we're perfectly pure. And that doesn't work. There's other people who say, no, we need military uprisings, take back the land on our own heels, then God will come back for us. And Jesus enters into this volatile context, and he shows us that the only answer has always been if God would fully descend from the mountain himself. See it? That's what we celebrate at Christmas. That's what the incarnation is. It's not just a baby in a manger, cool as that may be. It's a God who has said, I'm coming all the way down off the mountain to rescue my people who can never ascend the mountain. And isn't it interesting that Jesus, throughout the Gospels, uses a repeated imagery, the imagery of a wedding? Fascinating. He says, I am the bridegroom and you are the groom. In fact, Jesus comes to make a proposal, does he not? You could say that the gospel is a wedding proposal. That the gospel is for you and me, as well as all of the world, a wedding proposal that says, you've seen what I've done, right? On the cross and in the resurrection, I have set you free from sin and death. If you want it, come and have it. You can be my special possession, a treasured possession. Incredible. However, if you read the New Testament carefully and correctly, you'll understand that to fully embrace that means to embrace a whole new identity. That this isn't just a, oh, I get that, hooray. It's if I want that, if I really want that, then I've got to embrace a whole new identity as the bride of Christ. That's who I am now. Not the person I've been trying to make myself, not the kingdom I've been trying to build for myself, not the elevator I've been trying to construct to get up the proverbial mountain. Mm-mm. Instead, fully dependent on this one who has come, resting on his wings. The prophet Malachi said, when the Son of Righteousness comes, he will come like an eagle with healing in his wings. And so it is that Jesus is the final and ultimate fulfillment, even of Exodus 19. It's a reoffer of marriage, now not just to a select nation, but to the entire cosmos, the whole world. Famously, John says in John chapter 3, verse 16, right? The whole world Jesus died for, that no one should perish, that everyone should have the fullness of life. But if you're going to experience it, it's all about embracing that new identity. And part of it means obedience. Oh, here we go. Obedience to all those laws. No. Obedience to the covenant. Which covenant? The same one. Genesis 12. Where God says, I'm going to make you a special people. By the way, it's corporate and plural, not individual. It's really important in our modern American culture. But you're going to be a new person, a new reality. Take on a new identity for it. How do we know this is true? What does Peter write in 1 Peter chapter 2, verse 9? I think this is up on the screens. This is what Peter writes. You heard this language anywhere before? But you are a chosen people, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, God's special possession. Why? So that you may declare the praises of him who called you out of darkness into his wonderful light. How do you embrace the covenant? How do you take on that new identity? You embrace the reality that you are a kingdom of priests, a royal priesthood, that you are a holy nation, that you are meant to reflect the splendor and the glory and the truth of who God is to an onlooking world. That obeying Jesus means going where Jesus goes. It doesn't mean doing a ton of laws. You find as you go where Jesus goes and do what Jesus does, you end up keeping the law. Right? Incredible. And you embrace this reality, this sent missional reality, that this whole idea of being God's special possession is not for you to keep, but actually for you to share. What's Peter say? So that you may proclaim the excellencies and the goodness of God. Incredible. But I would say to you, just as God put the choice before the people, so too he puts the choice before us. For some of you here this morning, it's a choice that you've never made before. To say, you know what? This is actually what my life has always been pointing towards. What Jesus has accomplished is actually the thing I've been trying to do on my own for forever. And now I understand, or at least I'm beginning to understand for the first time. And we say, thank God for that. And we would love for you to talk to someone who brought you or to one of the leaders here at the church so we can talk more about that reality with you. For many of you, you say, well, I made that choice a long time ago. And we say, thank God for that. Keep making it. You say, well, I don't feel like God's treasured possession. Is that a God thing or a me thing? Is that a God's present thing or a me obeying thing? Right? One of the reasons that we tend to not feel close to God or to feel God's gaze or view on us is because we are not walking with him. I'm not talking about daily devotions, though those are wonderful and you should do them. I'm talking about actually doing the things God calls you to do in this world. When you do them, you can't help but be close to God because he's doing them and you're with him. And you will have this ongoing experience of treasured possession, holy nation, kingdom of priests, flying on wings like eagles. This is the offer that Jesus makes to us. But he doesn't force himself on us. But in the same way that the Old Testament people were forced to trust Moses, who for a long time proved to be quite trustworthy, and then, especially into the book of Numbers, proved to be less than trustworthy, a little irritable and a little frustrated, a little short-tempered, we instead are called only to trust Jesus. The one who can ascend the hill. The one who cleanses us. The psalmists say that anyone who has been met by God, their sins have been cleansed. They've been removed as far as the east is from the west. That's what we symbolically proclaim when we're baptized, by the way. There's no saving power in baptism. It's a public proclamation that I'm with him. It's a public washing. It says, in case anyone was curious, I'm with the Jesus guy. But there's more than that that happens with Jesus. There's more than a one-time ritual washing. Because if that was it, we'd need to do that over and over and over and over and over again. Instead, what the Apostle Paul reminds us is that in Jesus, we're actually new creations. Now, this is really important language, because when he invokes creation, he's saying that what Jesus actually does to us is he takes us back to a Genesis 1 and 2 reality, a pre-sin and fall reality. It does not mean in this earthly life we obtain any level of perfection, even in a given day, right? We're still broken people. What it means is that Jesus has done a work in our heart that has formed us as new creations. And the old is gone. You've been fully cleaned by Jesus. And you say, well, that's wonderful, but life is hard. I second that. Life is hard. Stuff happens. The headlines continue to report bad news in our world. And many of you have experienced really trying and difficult things in this world. And you say, well, how come I'm not soaring on wings like eagles? And how come I don't feel like a treasured possession in this moment? And I remind you that we live in what theologians rightly call an already not yet experience. That means that you are betrothed to Jesus, not yet fully married. Does this make sense? It does not mean that you're not assured to be fully married. It means we await that moment when Jesus returns. And so we have this experience of being joined to him, but still waiting and hoping. In the ancient Jewish customs, it's kind of fascinating. They would go through this betrothal ceremony, and then they would have a year. The groom would have a year to get things in order. And he would just show up at the bride's house and be like, it's time. It's wedding time, right? And then the whole neighborhood, whole community would go crazy and throw a huge wedding party. Well, God stands outside of time, so it's more than a year. But this is the imagery that Jesus is constantly presenting about himself, that we are betrothed to him, that he has gone to prepare things for us, and that when he comes back, it will be the full wedding experience, the great celebration. The trumpets will be blasting. There'll be massive celebration that awaits. Must you endure pain and difficulty in the now? Yes. How do you do it? Because you know you are assured of that. How? Because you're trusting Jesus, not Moses. You're trusting Jesus, not you. Jesus famously says this in John chapter 14. We'll finish with this. He says, do not let your hearts be troubled. Why would he say that to his disciples? Because their hearts are troubled, right? You believe in God, believe also in me. Now imagine this. We're 14 chapters into John. If you're a disciple, wouldn't you be like, we do believe in you. We've left our careers. We've left our families. We're doing this thing. Jesus has known from the beginning it's a moment by moment issue of belief. He says, my Father's house has many rooms. If that were not so, what I have told you that I am going there to prepare a place for you. And if I go and prepare a place for you, I will come back and take you to be with me, that you also may be where I am. You know the place to where I am going. Life is challenging. We live in the already not yet. Jesus says, do not let your hearts be troubled. Why? Because they are. How do you not let them be troubled? You remember that the one who has said of you that you are new creation will finally declare that over the whole earth upon his soon return, will undo all that is wrong in this world, will remove the tears and the pain and suffering from this world, and a massive wedding banquet will unfold. Can I pray with you?